Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is Somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. On today's episode, I welcome back my colleague friend, April Harder, to have a philosophical conversation of the relationship between narcissism and racism.
How can a white person be traumatized by a person of color when they're the perpetrator? Like, how can they be, like, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's because white people are taught to fear people of color. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, and again, it beautifully ties into the whole narcissism aspect as an expression, because it's a social threat.
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I am your host, Luis Mujica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music, and then my whole life transformed because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. If you haven't heard my previous sessions with April, interviews with April, I'd love for you to listen to them first. It's going to give you a lot of context. The very first one you want to listen to goes all the way back to episodes 5 and 6. It's 2 parts. It's nearly 2.5 hours of incredible information about the holistic lens of racism that April works with around the connection of racism with trauma. And I find it super important in understanding her language and her work and some of the things we may talk about in this episode. And then after you listen to those two, there's episode number 16. Which is all about the link between unprocessed trauma expressing itself through narcissistic traits and expressions, okay? So listening to those three episodes first are going to give you much more context for what we're talking about in this one. And this was kind of like an appetizer for me, because I mean, I could do hours with April about this work because it's so nuanced. She works very much like I do from her own bodily experience of whatever it is she's teaching or guiding people through, which means it's not as philosophical as it is experiential. And so it's unique. There isn't a book about this. There isn't a theory about this. She's creating it as she finds people healing by applying these methods and techniques and understandings. And I think for me, the most important thing we focus on in here, in this episode, is the macro of the narcissistic relationship between the white world and the black world. And I say white and black to make sense, because if you've heard my previous episodes, you'll understand that, you know, by now, hopefully you'll understand that white and black are complete social constructs. There's no such thing. Those ideas of color replaced culture. And they replaced culture hundreds of years ago so as to create a dominant culture that was more perfect and better, and a submissive culture that was imperfect and less worthy. And in that relationship, that cultural relationship of one group that's better and one group that's worse, you have a narcissistic attachment. You have a overt narcissistic response of, I'm perfect, look at me, everyone should be like me. If they're not, there's something wrong. I'll do whatever it takes to get on top, right? And that's the white supremacy that we talk about, the white construct, okay? So as you listen to this interview, you'll hear this will all come together for you probably. But we really let ourselves just kind of go through and find different truths and ideas and understandings. And I just have so much fun with April. So I hope you enjoy it. And I hope it gives you a little more understanding of how narcissism and racism, as well as other forms of othering, are connected, and how when we deal with narcissism on the micro level, which is how we relate to ourselves, what part of ourselves do we other or put in the shadows or deny, and then we see them in the world and we actually attach to those people the same hatred we feel about ourselves that they're reminding us of. That's the really nuanced, powerful work. And once you do that work, you simply can't, you just can't attach anymore in the same way as you used to those defense mechanisms, whether they're covert or overt, whether they're narcissistic or sexist, or you're fawning or you're flighting and fighting, these trauma responses, they just don't have anywhere to live anymore when you find that safety in yourself as a result of no longer hating parts of yourself that you've hid away or shunned because they were imperfect or there was something wrong with them. So this work to get to a place where you truly don't have the foundation to attach to racism or sexism or even very toxic capitalist constructs and theories and ways of living and thinking and relating, you simply can't attach that those anymore when your body has its own safety because it feels so bad, it feels so off. So my hope for everybody who listens to this episode and everything else that I've ever done or will eventually do more of, I hope when you look into the world and you notice how you relate to others, especially, quote, others, people so opposite of you, people that you think it's okay to hate, people that the media or your family have taught you to fear. Or if one individual really hurts you and then a group of people remind you of that individual, just noticing how you show up to the world, to the other, that will tell you how you're showing up to the other inside of you. And if that sounds strange or bizarre, it is. It's very psychedelic. And letting yourself move through that over time with a good guide will help you love all the parts within the parts that you may have hated or even denied were of you. And we lose that concept of pure, and we gain the reality of whole, which means I'm wholly integrated. I am an asshole, and I'm a loving friend. And I can be both, and they both live in me. And so when I see someone else expressing that, I don't fear them. I understand them. And that's the radical path toward actually healing any kind of discrimination. Okay, welcome back to the show, April Harder.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here. And just for any of you listening, you know, we can't see each other tonight. I can see April, she can't see me because there's several connection issues and I have a headache. So the two things together just made it easier to not have to work with the video. But it's a good headache. It's like skiing for 4 hours headache.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I'm really excited to have you back as usual. First of all, how are you?
Good.
Yeah.
I'm good. You know how I am. I like transform in lightning speed. So my wisdom has gone tenfold since I saw you.
Hey, I can't wait to hear how you're doing with everything. I think I was so interested in having you on, particularly for the relationship between narcissism and racism.
Oh yeah.
And you know, one of the things within your work with narcissism is that you so well educate people on is the relationship addiction. So explain to us, you know, anyone that isn't familiar, they can definitely, you know, look through and find your earlier episodes, which I'll talk about at the end. But can you tell us what that relationship is? Like what does narcissism have to do with racism?
Yeah, I think it's such a great question you're asking me, because I think if we can understand racism more from that narcissistic perspective, then we can understand that racism is an expression of narcissism, which is relationship addiction. I feel like the more we understand, the less judgmental we are, and the more that we can heal, which to me is a win-win situation. So that's why it is what it is, right? Mm-hmm. So first I have to start with relationship addiction, which is narcissism. Now, for those that are listening, like, and I kind of joked about this the other day, but it is the truth. And I realized upon introspection, which I'm doing constantly, I was like, wow, I'm a heretic. Like,
definitely.
I'm definitely a heretic. I'm a maverick and I'm a heretic and a pioneer.
That's such a good heretic laugh.
But heretic, like, is hilarious, because actually it really is true, because, you know, we talked about this. Like, when I, you know, first I committed heresy when I was doing anti-racism work.
Oh, yeah.
God forbid I have compassion for white people and their narcissism. That's taboo. You're not supposed to have compassion for the racist. That's against the rules, you know, that's heresy. So I was branded a heretic, essentially, within anti-racism circles, right? Mm-hmm. And then within the psychological field, I started talking about narcissism as relationship addiction. And I actually learned it from studying white people and the racism and whatnot. And I would say that it's probably like a, I don't know, Luis. I think it's like a 50-50. I think that our colleagues are a lot more open, but then the rest of the colleagues are like, she's a quack, you know, like, you know, and I laugh, but I mean, is it painful that I get socially rejected? Absolutely. It hurts. It does hurt, you know, it hurts. But at the same time, I'm like, I've come to accept that this is just what heretics go through. I mean,
that's right.
This is just the path, you know. This is like, I've just on a very deep spiritual level and person, I'm like, okay, this is my path. I'm a heretic. Okay. Mm-hmm. So,
which I have to interject, and can I read a post from you just to?
Yeah.
I'm celebrating you as I read this. I want to take the time to celebrate Black history and Black excellence this month by recognizing that I am making history as the first Black woman who has innovated and pioneered a new way to approach racism. That's something April posted, and I wanted to share it because I read that and I just, my heart fluttered, and I thought, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, I commend you. I celebrate you as well.
Thank you. You know, Luis, it's hard enough to be you know, a heretic just in the world, and then to be a Black heretic, holy shit. Like, that's like, I'm really going against the grain, but of course there's good reasons for doing it. So how is racism, narcissism, and how is racism relationship addiction? So we can look at it in the micro, and we can look at it in the macro. In other words, we're looking at relationships that are, you know, one-on-one or in small groups, stuff like that. Or we can look at the relationships that people have in the world, like a big old organism in this earth. And with racism, when we talk about systemic oppression, we're talking about, for example, colonization, exploitation, you know, again, systemic racism. What does that really mean? Like, we hear that white privilege, white supremacy, we hear all these terms, right? So on a macro level, on a huge relationship level, it's really mass narcissism. And so with narcissism and relationship addiction, it is very much, very much about succubusing. So we're talking, like, when we think about, for example, Black trans folks, right? We know that they get sexually abused, and then they're often killed, discarded. They don't matter, right? They're just used. So that's an example of, like, sexual exploitation, and it's also racist, and it's also transphobic. So those are multiple layers of narcissism. So we're looking at the intersectionality, essentially, of narcissism. Like, we're looking at the multiple ways that one can become addicted and exploit another human being. So in other words, with narcissism, and specifically with racism, it's a type of addiction. For example, a white person can become addicted to exploiting people of color. And we see that, like, in capitalism, we see that with, you know, the whole poverty gap, right? The wealth poverty gap, right? We're seeing that with COVID, how so many POC are struggling, you know? And so that's kind of like some, like, little, like, symptoms, little remnants of that mass narcissism, you know, like, what, why is it that people of color continue to struggle in so many ways, in a big, big way? And that's because of the narcissism, which is, I'm addicted to exploiting you. Essentially, that person becomes, slavery was narcissism. Well, it still is human trafficking. Yeah. Go for it.
No, I was going to ask you that. I was feeling like that beginning when race became the construct, even, and there was this idea of centering everything around white and male, essentially. And I'm just curious, you know, because when I hear, when you say these things, especially with phobias and especially with violence directed toward a certain group, I'm hearing that the narcissism in those experiences are the person, let's say the person propelling the trauma or the violence or the racism, from that person's body lives an extreme disconnect of their own pain. And something about that other group brings that pain up, but then they attach it to the other group. And then from there, they, let's say exploit or systematically oppress or physically violate. Can you just
fill in the blanks?
Yeah.
Totally, totally. So we're talking about that dissociation that you're talking about, which you'll see me talk on my posts all the time about, you know, the dissociation that happens in racism. But specifically where we need to fill the blank is that feared condition response, which I know you know, as a somatic therapist, I know you know what I'm talking about.
I know.
that trauma, man. So basically, I mean, you know that. So basically, white people are taught. Like, people wonder, like, somebody asked me on Instagram live, they said, how can a white person be traumatized by a person of color when they're the perpetrator? Like, how can they be, like, you know? And that's because white people are taught to fear people of color. And the reason is And again, it beautifully ties into the whole narcissism aspect as an expression, because it's a social threat. Because basically, when we act in narcissistic ways and we lie to ourselves and we lie to other people, and also that's connected to trauma, we will be very amoral because we're in that dissociative state. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, it's like, it's a threat. And we go into that fight, flight, or freeze response. Whereas I love how you like to talk about fawning, you know? And so it's like, you know, we go into that state. And so a white person, what's going on with them psychologically is, shit, like, at that moment, let's say it's a white liberal, because a lot of white liberals follow me, right? Like, let's say that, right? They may or may not have been taught explicit hate or fear against people of color by their parents, but they learned it in other ways. But even then, even if, let's say, take that out, why? Like, it's like, how did that happen? How did that happen? And it happened because in that moment, let's say they're with some other white people, and then they see racism. They see some type of verbal abuse or emotional abuse to a person of color. In that moment, they're like, oh my God, like, that's a threat, because they could look racist if they don't do something. And if they look racist to their friends or even to other people, that's a social threat. Or the social threat could be, for example, oh, my white friends, if I actually said something, even though authentically it's coming up for me, like I feel authentically like I need to say something. This is really feels comfortable to me. Like I'm not talking about saverism, like a legit, like, I don't like what's going on and I feel like I need to speak up. But same white person might think, but this is a social threat. Because what if my white friends don't have the same values as I do?
And it's important, when I hear you say social threat, I hear you saying it threatens that person's secure attachment to their white group. And in this example, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I think that's so important, because you talked a lot in the last episode about secure attachment and narcissism. They're married, essentially. Insecure attachment, I should say, or attachment ruptures. And could we just do a little two-minute kind of follow up on that, or a reminder what the relationship between narcissistic responses and any kind of attachment wounds. From that example you gave, actually.
Well, you know, since the last time we talked, I've really discovered something really amazing that I want to also add to it, which is the brain opioid theory of social attachment. It's kind of interesting. A lot of us in our psychological field, we don't know much about it. And I wasn't even like looking for it intentionally, but I was like doing a little side research and I came across it, and it very much substantiates basically what's happened in narcissism, which is this. When we're growing up, our endogenous opioids, for those listening, it basically means we have like our own painkillers. We have like our little painkillers, little opioid painkillers, naturally, as well as cannabinoids. Like we have our, believe it or not, folks, why when you smoke weed, you know, you're going to feel great because it activates your natural cannabinoids in your body. Right. So the thing is that there's this thing called the brain opioid theory of social attachment. It's nothing I made up. It's been around for a while, I think for 20 some years or whatever. Anyway, they've done brain scans, neuroscientists have done brain scans and all that good stuff. And basically, when we're kids and we don't get the kind of nurture that we need, unfortunately, our ability to produce endogenous opioids, it reduces. And basically experience an endogenous opioid deficit. And so therefore we lack the ability to self-soothe at a capacity that would really help us stay within that window of tolerance. So
that's amazing.
I wonder if
there's like literal relationship addiction born from that, because you're addicted to getting those opioids through the codependent attachments or whatever.
Absolutely. And we know that we have an opioid addiction in our country. So it's like, it's complex trauma, basically. So exactly. So a lot of time when people, they say, April, you know, why do you got to say the word narcissism? It's so stigmatizing. I don't want a label. And it's like, but boo, it's relationship addiction. And it started when we were little, where we became addicted to narcissistic supply. So basically, so here's where it gets like gray area tricky, but so anyway, yeah, that's the point of it. So that's the point of the secure attachment situation is when you experience insecure attachment, the result is endogenous opioid deficit, and then you biologically struggle with self-soothe because like literally the attunement that a parent has with their kids literally neurobiologically like literally teaches them to basically self-soothe, because we know kids can't self-soothe really. I mean, parents are that pillar to help them learn how to self-soothe and also helps them neurobiologically develop those endogenous opioids so that later they don't become narcissists essentially.
And when you say that, when you say become narcissist, you specifically mean there's this then addictive quality to how they socialize, right? Like whether it's the covert or the overt. But either way, overt or covert, they're socializing in this addictive, manipulative way to satisfy those opioids and feel this like chemical safety, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, because even to this day, like when you and I talk, we enjoy ourselves, our little endogenous opioids are like popping off, you know, like what happened, you know? But that's like a healthy, secure thing. Like that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You know, but we're not exchanging narcissistic supply. We're doing it mutually and it's beautiful. But narcissism is like when we act in narcissistic ways, we're gonna lie to ourselves and tell ourselves it's okay to cross somebody's boundary or allow somebody to cross our boundary. And that actually happens even also in, of course, abuse and neglect for those who are listening, basically. And the truth is like, we unfortunately, as children, we get groomed by our parents to think it's okay that love and abuse should coexist. And that neglect and love should coexist. And like, it shouldn't, because it's going to cause us to be really confused. And inside our minds, we're like, oh, so now it's normal and okay to be abused and neglected. And also, I guess, receive love too. And that doesn't mean like, again, folks who are listening, no one's immune. Like we've all messed up. We all, you know what I mean? But like, we get used to that, unfortunately. And that is like, so basically we become narcissists when we're children. Because if we don't get what we need as kids, like we're basically parents are planting the seeds of narcissism, because they themselves, the parents, also are narcissists, and they didn't get what they needed as kids. So that's where the intergenerational trauma comes into play. And then Louise, could you remind me back to where we were going to get with that? Cause I want to make sure we stay on target as well.
You know, I was just naturally going to say something. I think it's bringing us back. And if it's not, it's bringing us wherever we're going. And I'm fine with that too. But when you just said that, it made me want to ask you. So in my mind, I'm seeing, you know, an intergenerational trauma of, like you just said, like abuse and love or neglect and love, or, you know, whatever the overcoupling was, which essentially says, you know, like this is one way, endure this for the secure attachment, actually. So it's break the boundary to get the secure attachment. Now when I imagine someone going into the world, like within the lens of racism, imagine someone going into the world from that body. And this is so covert. You know, they're not walking around saying, I love
them. I got the answer. I know. I forgot about it. I was going to talk about implicit and explicit. And now
Bring it on.
We're going to tie it in. So this is the nuance that I've learned over time working with white people. So you know how we hear the terms like explicit, implicit bias, right? Okay. So we know that there's implicit and explicit memory, and the explicit memories are basically like things that we've learned. And then we have implicit memory, which is like associative, and it's more like if this, then that, or like trauma, unfortunately, can be a feared conditioned response where we're like, oh, I'm scared of that. And now my body's going to react a certain kind of way, right? So here's what happens with, look at me, look, the complexity of racism. I'm just like, shit. So basically, white people carry with them explicit and implicit feared conditioned responses. Mm-hmm. Like fear, they are taught to fear implicitly and explicitly against people of color.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the implicit is the real sneaky part, because the implicit part is, it, as you know, some of y'all are saying, in other words, it means that when we learn things in books and also like learn in our family, someone says something, it's going, when I mean implicit, folks, I mean, it's that subconscious stuff that like we kind of can't get a sense of what's going on.
Yeah.
So folks, like the explicit memory stuff is conscious awareness of memory. Like we can recall this stuff, like just, we can just pull it out of our hat. And then the implicit stuff is the stuff that's hidden, subconscious, like you don't know. And that's where the complex trauma comes into play.
Got it.
With the implicit, because when white people are taught explicitly by their parents to be afraid of people of color, as you know, it influences their autonomic nervous, it influences their hypothalamus, their hippocampus, their amygdala, like it just puts stuff on fire. Like this now teaches physiologically in the body, the white person to be afraid of people of color. And they, that's when, of course, when they get triggered, they dissociate. The implicit part, which is much more nuanced, which is mostly where I do my work, more in the implicit, the blind spots, the spots that people can't figure out. This is a combination of growing up in abuse and neglect from one's, let's say, white parents, which is a fear conditioned response, mixed in with the explicit learned fear stuff being taught in society.
It makes so much sense to me.
So then when, exactly. So then when you combine it all, as therapists, we know like, oh, that like totally makes sense. Like, oh, that's why white people go into trauma responses and dissociate when they're accused of racism, when they're in a situation where they feel like they have to follow the rules of anti-racism or they're going to get canceled. Like that's a huge social threat. They could lose their job, their livelihood. They're like, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so it's like at that, and they're going to act immoral. And that's what you'll see online too. You'll see a white person desperately try to figure it out. They go into a dissociative defense mechanism because they're actively dissociating. And what the influencers want them to do is they want them to submit, which as you and I know is one of the defensive types, to submit.
And that's relationship.
Fawning, actually. It's fawning, actually.
Well, it's a complete fawning response. And so if we look at the group that's saying we're going to cancel you if you don't, that group is the overt narcissist.
Yes.
And then the covert narcissist, the fawns or does the white saviorism or whatever you want to call it, they're the covert, you know, that's the covert. So the one is supplying the other one in that dynamic.
Yes, because that's, absolutely.
That's so amazing to me. And now this
crazy,
is...
crazy, right? It's you're bringing on a heretic on your show. I mean, like...
Well, it's really a fellow heretic bringing on another heretic.
I know you are. That's why we...
I know you are, but what am I? It's, you know... you know, what's interesting to me, what I'm really curious about is the more I study racism and I work with people and I go into my own, you know, upbringing.
Yes.
And I just start to wonder, I have this question around, I'm trying to think the right way to ask it. In this discussion around narcissism specifically, does the construct of racism give that narcissism like a target? Like is that versus I actually hate someone of color. Like, okay, there is a place that has for generations been acted. I feel that. I see that in my society. That's where my narcissism can go to, whether it's overt, covert. Can you explain that? If that makes sense, that question makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to tie that back into the explicit, implicit memory.
Okay.
So the thing is that it's hard. It gets complicated because, okay, so it's like exactly where is the target? Where can we pinpoint? Where can we address therapeutically? And first, what I can tell you is that most white people, in my observation, even when they commit overt acts, are still actively dissociating. So we know at a minimum, we need to target the implicit memory. Mm-hmm. So we know it's subconscious. And so the thing is
that's why you hear like dozens of white cops say, I don't even know why I pulled the trigger. Like, I don't remember.
They just don't remember. Yep. Yeah. They dissociated right there. Totally trauma response. And so, so they dissociate, they're afraid, and then they do something amoral because they feel a social threat. And so the target at a minimum is associated with implicit memory. And it has to do with what I mentioned, which was, what are these fear? What are these fear? What's the fear conditioning? What? So fear conditioning would definitely be attachment wounds, childhood abuse and neglect. So that would be therapeutically very much eventually the target. Now, one of the things that I learned when I finished my EMDR training was that I like how my instructor said, you know, with complex trauma, you really want to like prune it. You want to prune it like slowly, really slowly. And that's what I do with my patients. And even my coaching clients, we kind of prune where through interactive like questioning and stuff like that and homework assignments, they're doing introspection. And really, Luis, we're peeling back the layers of the lies because so if you're taught explicit lies about people of color that they are to be feared and hated, that's one thing. But when you have an implicit, deep internal, you know, negative cognition, like in other words, you have a lie you tell yourself. Let me give you an example. So recently, my coaching clients, like with the new and final batch of the racism recovery, they basically, there are a couple people when we're going through homework assignment where every week we kind of peel back the layers. And it first started, Luis, so this is my help, like when you're working with folks, we took the actual like triggering situation. So I asked them to write down five really, really triggering, racially triggering situations, right? Like super triggering. Like really like brought a physiological response, right? And we continue to take those five and we dissect it like week by week by week, little components. So we looked at, they learned about their arousal states. They learned about the fact that they have an autonomic nervous system that although we can influence it, it's really automatic when we go into fight, flight, freeze. You know, I mean, we do, right?
So you're helping them embody these, you know, reflexes essentially.
Yeah. So they can, so that they can understand that, that like there's so much more complexity to their racist behavior, right? So understanding their arousal states when they're acting like in that racially triggering situation. Then they're learning about like their, then the defense, then the dissociation. So then it's like, okay, I'm going in this arousal state. If I'm in an arousal state too long, such as hypoarousal, I'm getting like really hopeless, depressed. And like, I could, for example, depersonalize, derealize, like, and for those seeing like depersonalization is basically you're beginning to feel your body is like kind of distorted. Okay. Like you don't feel like you're in your body very well. And then derealization is your environment feels distorted. Okay. So also the dissociative amnesia. So as they're recanting like these very racially triggering situations where they know, like basically they acted in a racist way, then it's like they understand their arousal state. They understand their dissociation. And then we're getting deeper into defense mechanisms and going, okay, now just this past week, this past Sunday, I posted, I said, okay, what kind of dissociation is it? Derealization, depersonalization, dissociative amnesia, or a defense mechanism? And then within the defense mechanism, I said, oh, every defense mechanism has a lie every single time. So I said, What lie did you tell yourself in that moment when it was all going down? And I've had some fascinating, of course, you know, fascinating. I'm so proud of them. They're doing so good. They're really being honest about like the ways that they've lied to themselves. Mm-hmm. Such as an example.
And the lie props up the narcissistic.
Yeah.
The lie like, props up that structure, I'm assuming. Like validates the action or the expression.
Yeah, because so in other words, in order to use someone in narcissistic supply, you need to lie to yourself and tell and justify the use.
Okay, now pause there. That's exactly what I was trying to get at. So the word you just used to use someone in a narcissistic supply in a relationship addiction, you have to justify the use.
And that's perfectionism. And that's perfectionism. And
well, that's my question.
And that's connected to white supremacy.
That's exactly what I was trying to get to. When I was talking about the racial construct.
On a macro level means I'm white, I'm perfect, therefore I have a right. I can justify not paying this black person what they deserve to have, and I'm going to exploit them financially, and I'm going to be racist.
That's let's like sit there for a minute, because like that like I feel that in my heart, like that's what the answer I was looking for, because I didn't know the words, but that's exactly right. Like the white supremacy and the culture built around the centering
very narcissistic culture.
It's literally like whiteness is the perfection, everything else is sub.
White is right.
Or other.
White is perfect. Yeah.
And straights in there, and males in there, all those things are in there. But that's what I was curious about, because that on the, now you're talking about the macro levels.
Yeah.
That's where on these macro levels, there's these cultural relationship narcissistic addictions, right?
Yes.
That's so profound.
And we can see that in sexism too. And we can see that, like, for example, I'm a male. Like, male privilege is like, you know, male supremacy is I'm a male, therefore I'm perfect. And because I'm perfect, I'm entitled to violate your boundaries, which is overt, it's overt narcissism. So narcissism is unfortunately, and it is what it is, Louise, it's a human condition. And I truly believe that basically, if we don't address our narcissism as a species, we will not emotionally evolve.
I agree.
Because like, I feel that as humans, like when we look at our evolution, we have made such incredible scientific advances, so many advances in so many ways. And there are all these ethical dilemmas like, oh, well, if you do CRISPR, which is like genetic modification, or like if you do whatever kind of science, space travel, whatever, you know, people say, oh, you can't do that because it's wrong, because then it could lead to something bad. Well, but see, we're not dealing with the narcissism. So yeah, it is going to potentially lead to something bad. So I mean, like, we could take anything.
Well, there's really a wisdom in what you just said, because there's another post that I jotted down here that you wrote that I thought was really important. And from what you said, it speaks to that. And I don't have the whole thing written, but essentially it's, when we examine our own unique narcissistic traits, we're acknowledging our own unique levels of corruption.
Absolutely.
And that's the piece, is like, if your mind says, well, they're narcissist and I'm not, that's narcissistic.
Yes, it is, so, because it's denial.
Right, yeah. So it's like befriending and understanding and witnessing your own narcissism is the way you heal in yourself.
It is, because if we want to go down that rabbit hole, because when we talk about complex trauma in parts, because we got to do parts work.
Correct. And if you're not aware of this, this one part is kind of like hanging out in the shadows and you're just ignoring that it exists, but it's running your life.
And it is that shadow. You know, people always talk about shadow work, and I'm like, what do you think shadow work is?
It's narcissism. That's right.
So it's
That's right.
You know, the narcissism, exactly. I like how you said that. It's like this little thing creeping inside, you know, like you just got, but you know what? Like I came up with something last week and I had never thought of it before. And I thought to myself, you know, but something I consistently see with narcissists is that basically, as narcissists, we grew up in a narcissistic society, and then we're conditioned to not be who we truly are. Mm-hmm. We're punished if we try to be who we are. Mm-hmm. And that's very traumatic in and of itself. So when we talk about narcissism, I feel that it's not just shadow because it's the malefic things that we do. I also think it's shadow because it's also connected to who we truly are. And unfortunately, we actually take our true personality and bury it.
I love and that. Yeah,
it literally is the shadow. Like we literally, it's only a shadow because we've made it a shadow because we push it down and repress it. But if we can look at that, and that's to me very much so why narcissism is a personality. So it doesn't have to be NPD. Like people always have to be narcissistic person. No, like,
I'm glad you're saying that. It's it's a way of being versus a, exactly.
Yes, it's an addiction. It's a spectrum. I mean, just like anything else, you're going to be.
And a trauma response, as you said last time.
It's so nuanced. Trauma response, attachment trauma, attachment disorder, addiction, and I love to focus on exactly the addiction piece because when you violate somebody's boundaries to get a hit of narcissistic supply, or you let someone you lower your boundaries to get a hit, that's when we're doing a narcissistic exchange. And unfortunately, a lot of our relation like narcissism, unfortunately, when we do this, it does feel good, but then it like. Yeah. Then we're not actually being who we are to another person, like who we truly are. Because again, we're pushing that to the shadow. And so really we're being super fake to one another. We're not being really authentic to one another because a lot of narcissists are really afraid of social rejection.
Well, it's interesting when you said we're being fake to one another, I heard something in my mind that might be controversial. But it's like even our hatred is fake, right? If we think about it from that narcissistic place, it's that part of ourselves, like you said, that's been shadowed or othered. Because we've othered that part of ourselves, then we have to project that onto correct, right. And it's not even real.
That's literally the cause of discrimination in the world. Because white people. And it's interesting, Luis, because one of the things that's so popular in social justice spaces is decentering whiteness. Oh, it's so popular. So popular, it's like PB&J. And yet, unfortunately, it doesn't work because if you decenter your white, if you decenter yourself, basically like you're rejecting yourself and you're not holding space, and actually you'll trigger more dissociation.
That's right.
So that's where I see a lot of those shame spirals occur on Instagram where white people get called out and then they end up in this shame spiral. And we talked about before in the podcast how, you know, white people will, I mean, they'll get to a point where they'll be so terrified.
That's where the performative allyship comes in to save their image.
They're desperate. And so unfortunately, and this is just unfortunately the, you know, again, I say this word many times, but it's true. What I say is heresy and heretical, but it is the truth. Like, unfortunately, most anti-racism educators actually give white people what they want, which is performative allyship, and it's narcissistic supply. Because at that point, the white person is way more concerned about their reputation. They're acting in a very narcissistic way. They can't help it. They're going into survival mode. They want to make sure that they're so embedded and entrenched in a narcissistic culture in our world that it's like, please let me pay you, POC, to give me some rules so that I look good and I can be more perfect looking. And that's the insidious part. And so white people are not going to influencers and educators to actually stop their racism. They think they are, but they're not. Subconsciously, they're actually going there because they don't want to get embarrassed. They don't want to, they are trying to protect their reputation because perfection means everything. If I'm perfect, I can have a good life.
And in that embarrassment, to allow the embarrassment would be their healing, because then their narcissistic tendencies would be, you know, absolved essentially, to put it that way.
To numb it out.
Correct.
Like I mentioned before, because a narcissist will numb their pain. So then what we'll do when we regress into our narcissism is we will use narcissistic supply in our relationships to activate endogenous opioids, but that's where we become like clingy addicted. And that comes back to what you talked about originally with saviorism. Saviorism is absolutely an addiction to people of color and their plight. Mm-hmm. It is not about like reparations. And it's interesting. I had a conversation with my husband the other day, and I know we got to go in a little bit, but I basically said, babe, like I told my white husband, I said, babe, you know, I go, it's interesting to me because if we were really being honest about reparations and really like being honest, like really, truly honest about like really neutralizing our narcissism in society, it wouldn't just be reparation. It would be, we as Americans would stop colonizing, exploiting other countries, black and brown countries.
Absolutely.
Like we would just, that shit would stop. Can I just say that? Like, that shit would stop. We're being honest. Like we would stop taking tribal lands. We would stop doing all this, but capitalism is its own narcissism.
No, you're so right. And great, you know? I've gotten so many letters from our last podcast about the link between narcissism and trauma, because it's been so enlightening for people to really understand like what you just said 10 minutes ago about NPD versus just the expression and the nuanced spectrum of narcissism. Like there's like with the autism spectrum, you know, it's like the same thing with narcissism. And and it's trauma response. So it's, like you said, it's very nuanced. It's very innocent in lots of ways.
In lots of ways it is.
That's what's so controversial about you. But that's what brings me to your work because, and I'm going to read, we have a couple minutes, I hope. Do you have a couple more minutes?
Yeah, I have a few more minutes.
I just want to read this post of yours that said, you know, there is a big difference between shunning and setting boundaries. Most of us think shunning is setting boundaries, but it's not. It's overt narcissism. And when you were talking about the anti-racist educators, I see a lot of times, lots of shunning on both sides of the skin color.
Yes.
Skin color. So you have the white people that get together and shun themselves.
And they shun themselves.
And it becomes like euphoric. You know, there's like this euphoria in like calling yourself an asshole because you're white.
Oh, yeah.
And I find it to be just so like cyclical in the narcissism.
It's insidious because this is high. Because this is hypoarousal and those endogenous, when you submit, it releases the vagal, or the vagus nerve, it releases and it's a drug. It absolutely.
Correct.
Correct. It's true.
And so we either have these extremes of white people say, okay, I'm going to go like be talked to like shit because I deserve it. Or like, I'm going to learn these ways to look better. But there's no place in between of like, where do I hold my vulnerability? Which is the narcissism coming out.
That's right. And that's because it's not trauma-informed. Because narcissism within our field, as you know, it's not trauma-informed. And I wrote a post today actually about that. And I was pretty bold about it, but it needed to be said. Like I said that what society knows about narcissism isn't grounded in reality or experience, like actual experience. It's based off of speculation and rumors and assumptions. And it's just not trauma-informed. And people tell me all the time, they really think I must be making stuff up. They're like, do people really call you and say, I'm a narcissist, I need treatment? I'm like, yes, they do.
Yes, they really do.
I mean, clearly I wouldn't be in business. Like,
Well, that's what I love about what you do. The same thing with, but it's because of how you show up to it is why anybody would call you and say I'm a narcissist, because you're consistently saying, I don't hate you because you're a narcissist. I just want to show you what it feels like and why it's there and how we can work with it.
That's because
And that's very rare.
That's because I know I'm a narcissist in recovery and I understand, like, I think a big part of destigmatizing is really owning my own narcissism and understanding my own narcissism.
Absolutely.
And as any addict, you know, it's like, I'm a addict in recovery, you know, like I'm not, and I think we all know, like those that have, you know, that have struggled with addiction. And as a therapist, you're helping people with addiction. You legitimately walk the walk. Like there's so much wisdom to be gained, you know, like how you talk about detoxing from caffeine, you know what I'm saying? So you're like, hey, I was addicted to caffeine and it was destroying my body. And you're like, this is not good for me. And I had to detox. I think that's why we have a lot in common too, Louise, because like we're in many ways, like we're in a lot of the same business, which is like detoxing the body, detoxing the mind.
Absolutely.
And due to addiction, that's addictions just all over the place. You know what I mean? And narcissism is just one of, you know, many types of addictions. You know?
Well, the commonality of our work, which I especially appreciate from coming from you, because you're not in somatics as much. You get it, obviously. But it's like, it's rare to find someone who's a licensed clinical social worker who gets somatics the way you do around addiction.
I'm working on it. I want to get more training in somatics.
You really get it. Because when you understand the chemical response, the way you said it earlier in the program when you were saying, that's why we love pot, because it's activating what's already in us. Like, our bodies are the source of the addiction. So anything can become a substance. It's not about criminalized substances.
It's behavioral addiction.
Right? Yes. You know, and that's the piece.
For people listening, I bet at this point you might be wondering, because I know that I always get this question, which is, well, April, I'm not in Colorado. So like, how can I get for my narcissism? And I want you all to know that if you're listening to this and you follow me, and then of course you're learning about narcissism from, you know, Luis as well, and you're learning all kinds of stuff about your complex trauma, and you're like, shit, like, how do I deal with this? I need you to understand some things to kind of prep you. One, most therapists are not going to think you're a narcissist, and that's because I'm pioneering a lot of this stuff. You know, I'm pioneering, you know, we mentioned racism a lot, but narcissism as an addiction, because it's not in the DSM and because it's very fresh. That's just natural. And a lot of therapists, especially if they don't delve in it, are not going to get it. But therapists that help people with addiction, they are totally going to vibe with it. So I find that therapists that work with people who struggle with addiction, if you tell, you know, a therapist, I'm a narcissist, and let's say they're an addiction specialist, but you want to look for a therapist that understands behavioral addiction, because narcissism is a behavioral addiction. So basically, you want to work with a therapist that can help you with behavioral addiction. And that's what you're looking for. And of course, you know, attachment focused. And that's huge. If you can find a therapist that does somatic work, I love me some EMDR, and that they specialize in behavioral addiction, I feel like y'all are going to find a real sweet spot for a therapist, hopefully, knock on wood, because they'll hold space for your behavioral addiction, because that's a very special type of therapy, working with people with behavioral addiction.
And I'm going to second that, because my colleagues that work with that, when we talk about your work and the narcissism, they get it right away.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the main reason is when you focus on DSM, you're focusing on a stamped identity, like a fixed state. When you're focused on behavioral and you're focused on somatics, you're focused on energy and how it expresses itself. It's very complex and nuanced and very primitive and intuitive. And so your own experience.
Good. It's so true.
And you're, like you said about experience, your own experience makes you a master in it, and you can feel and see it. And that's beyond identity. That's expression and movement. Thank God, because we want that to be beyond it. We don't want our identity to be narcissist. We want to understand it as expression.
Yeah, because, I mean, narcissism, we can absolutely, you know, in that very egocentric way where our addiction becomes who we are.
That's right.
Okay? And that's why it's a personality disorder. But the goal in recovery is, it's not who you are.
Correct.
Addiction does not define you.
That's right. We're going to end on those words, because that's what anyone that is experiencing this probably needs to hear. So as always, I thank you so much for being here. Someday I just imagine we'll tear it up somewhere together. Thank you for your beautiful work, my friend.
Thank you for interviewing me.
For more information on April's work, you can go to Instagram and follow her at Narcissism Recovery Center, or you can go to her website, narcissismrecoverycenter.com, and there you will find her podcast, her blog, which is great, and a bunch of different services, including lectures, courses, and individual psychotherapies or coaching sessions. So there are many different ways to work with her. She also has a Patreon. That's it. I really thank you for listening, and I look forward to hearing where this takes you. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice, what's your body doing right now? Sit with it. Let it speak to you. And let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen. For all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. For more information on my work, including my online courses and healing circles, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook, where I share weekly philosophies and resources to help you release stress and trauma from your body so that you can live a happier life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.